The degrowth is the anti-monopoly, do-it-yourself movement.
And what are you looking for in terms of talking to others?
Okay, so see interest in micro-renewables, community-owned energy projects, and also a fair bit on waste. Okay. I've written a fair bit about corruption as well, which is quite good.
Yeah.
Because corruption and waste go hand in hand. So alternative energy systems, which is the way I kind of like to think about it, are those small-scale community-based electricity projects where they're owned by the community as a community business. So coming from that need to save energy, need to stop wasting stuff, I came across degrowth, and I can't remember where it was, some years ago in a chat or something, I think, and began to kind of look at what it was and what it represented, and thought to myself, what's the relevance of degrowth to that system and why is it necessary?
Mm.
It's been represented in a fairly kind of vague and ideological way at the moment. There's no arguing against the fact that it will take place anyway. It's going to take place. And it is taking place around the world where you run out of fish, and you're going to run out of food, and you're going to run out of soil and water and so forth. So either a natural, perverse degrowth will take place anyway, or governments will start to cotton on to the idea and start to understand that it's either that or not lose the planet.
From those micro-renewables, if you could sort of draw some lines, what that means?
Yeah, so people, like idiots like Ed Miliband, keep using the word like renewable energy. The UK's always had great capacity to do that. My old man used to work in wave energy back in the 1970s, so there is renewable energy, but if all you do with renewable energy is plug it into mass production capitalism, you haven't changed the system at all and you haven't really made any difference, because waste is still continuing, maybe at a slightly lower rate.
Mm.
So alternative energy systems, which is the way I kind of like to think about it, are those small-scale community-based electricity projects that we've been trying to set up in Kenya, Bangladesh, Lesotho, where they're owned by the community as a community business, and they are not necessarily stuck to the grid, although they tend to try to, because that's where the money is. But the idea is that it should be a community-owned business, and that it should fit in with what kinds of activities a poor community is up to, you know, livestock, or growing chickens, or hair shops for women. In other words, it's community-owned business for the benefit of the community. Now, that's just cooperative level stuff in a lot of people's cases, but you can turn energy sources into that if that's what you try and do, rather than make it into an extractive sucker out of money, which is what is being done in a lot of places.
So micro-renewables can include things that don't sort of use too much energy also, like you were saying, hair shops?
That's kind of an axiomatic assumption, that they will use less energy, but the idea, what we were trying to work on, is to plug them into community needs in a way that means they use less energy, but it's more purposefully directed to the needs of the community, particularly low-income communities. We're trying to do this project.
Because traditionally it's all template of doing it all as a big thing, really, and none of this kind of community care. So I'm a bit sceptical about that one, because I don't know if they would actually do that. Like, why would they do that?
Which one are you sceptical about?
So why would they sort of do things that would be more directed towards the community when it doesn't really get them any money?
Well, that's the crux of the matter, isn't it? And that's the crux of the massive overseas food waste system that it's built to make money. Now, unless you can get to the point where you build a critical junction between massive waste causing climate change being caused by profitability, and get people to accept and understand that, and the government as well, then your stuff. It's no good thinking about degrowth if you're also just thinking about the new BMW 92 that's coming out next year. And well, you know what I'm saying. How many phones did you have this year? And have you swapped a telly? And the mass of consumption goods that we take for granted, which we do, realistically.
Yeah. new fridge, new washing machine.
Capitalism is a determined background to dissatisfy you. Capitalism makes you want more stuff, and it makes you feel bad because you haven't got it. It leaves you in a constant state of dissatisfaction because you are not consuming enough.
So with the energy side of things, can I ask if you've ever made any electricity or had some of these kinds of ideas yourself?
I have personally helped set up small-scale solar projects in Kenya and somewhat in Bangladesh as well, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Wires.
That's good.
Actually built them from scratch. So, I mean, I'm no kind of technician. Anyone who asks me, I'm a social geographer, you know, I can't count to 20 without taking my socks off, but I have helped to take part in construction.
Okay, that's good. And can I ask why it wasn't in the UK, for example?
That is a good question, because at the time, when aid was still a thing, the UK aid outlets were quite interested in alternative energy projects and alternative energy systems. Now, USAID has disappeared completely, and the interest in those things has declined substantially. But there are small-scale community projects in the UK, energy projects, that exist now, and plenty of places in the UK that could be hived off onto smaller community-level projects. And that, you know, you could build a house these days, which can power itself, you know, with heat pumps, air pumps, solar panels, and so on and so forth. But people who are building houses these days resist it, and also they would make you pay through the nose for it.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of things. Technically, you can do it, okay? Technically, you could start hiving off communities from the grid, setting them up with their own power systems, providing local power adjuncts. Politically and commercially, you wouldn't be allowed to do it.
Oh yeah, under the radar, let's say, but to do.
Yeah. So for smaller community projects, for instance, also, you could combine what I call alternative energy sources, so like combine wind and sun. Politicians in particular get obsessed by the idea of one source of energy. It's either solar power, or in some places it's wave power, but you don't have to have just the one source. And I wrote a Pacific Island adjunct a while back about multiple different sources of alternative energy possibilities, and that they could be using all of those sources rather than just saying, no, we have to have solar, we have to have wind, or whatever. Oh. I can send it if you're interested.
Yeah.
It's a couple of pages. It's easy to read, and we were working for the British government at the time, and they wanted some fast response aspects to how small island states can provide themselves with power. Maybe 10 years old now, but it's still valid.
I see. So trying to get islands going for themselves, and that was the reason for that kind of funding or research for it.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I'd really like to copy, but do ourselves.
Yes.
Part of some of this is like having a place to go to that you can really consider thinking about it, and not just in a kind of, oh, it would be a nice idea to make my own fridge, but to really say, like, no more buying fridges, or this will be my last one, and I'll prepare my own fridge and understand how to repair it, and sort of like the full life cycle. Like, this is like real focus now for me.
It's how you make those crossovers, how you persuade people that it's no good thinking about the mass of consumption goods that we take for granted, which we do, realistically.
Yeah. If people could really do a DIY project, it's possible, also from a non-electrical background. I've done like a bicycle cinema, you know, pedaling, and people can watch on a projector using the pedal power. Like, that's a good kind of hope that it is possible.
Well, I've got a photo from Nicaragua, which is where I did my PhD, of a guy who built wave energy projects out of old lawnmower parts. I'll send you the photo of that. It's really quite interesting.
Okay.
And he reckoned that if you had a stream or a water body moving past your house that had a a 1 meter drop. Uh-huh. You could just stick this thing in and it would provide some form of source of power to your house. So some of it's very crude, but still functional.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that people don't know about, because they think of alternative energy as being somehow technically weird or out of their reach, yeah, or so on and so forth, but it's not, you know.
Yeah, I definitely know the stream power, or if you have a water source passing you anyway, like, let's say, gravitational water flow, that can definitely be used.
Yes.
And without these kinds of major investments, and trying to get people out of the mentality of, oh, I have to buy constantly alternative energy, or at least I could buy something much smaller.
So the question is, for degrowth, is if you can persuade people that degrowth of the system, the archaic grid-based system, into more community.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of these things, if I could take a side topic, keeping the electricity companies in mind still, we as a people see the same pattern happening with anything good in the world. It's
yes.
That classic business model of innovation, let's try, we don't have it now, we can do it. And then you get to like, okay, we've done it now. And then it's like, oh, we need to milk this for all it's got, you know. And then it goes back down like the circle kind of towards, almost towards zero again, where it's like, we're going to milk it until like the wheels fall off, or squeeze the hell out of this thing, make it so useless and full of adverts. So quick shout to Luis Rossman, because that was what I was going to actually mention to you. He's one of these consumer rights people. He's very tied in with waste, because you have like thermostats that they push a new update to, and then you can't use it afterwards unless you pay a subscription fee. You have fridges now that force advertising. So I could list you, we could list each other a lot of these things, but basically we need to expect every single product or device or whatever we have to go back to
the degrowth is the anti-monopoly. There's the do-it-yourself movement in the US and in the UK, I think, which is the right to, you should be able to, if you buy a product or something,
right to repair.
Right to repair, isn't it? Yeah. So these are a very direct political crap. If you don't want to, nobody should be able to make you explain it. Just take you down the shop to get it done.
Yeah.
But you should not be forced by a monopolist to depend on them for very expensive repairs that don't possibly charge you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of crux of the matter. Their profitability comes from depriving us of access the less we agree to pay the price that they force on us. And as for Roberts people, well, that's just a load of rubbish to them, because they just do what they're told by the government. So there's no real restriction on supply, which is why the UK has the highest prices of electricity, in Europe, definitely, and probably in most parts of the world, because of our monopolisation. Wikipedia says that British Gas, EDF, E.ON, RWE, Npower, Scottish Power, and then there was SSE, and then OVO took over SSE, the big six. But if you go through, I've just been through on Google's AI overview, there's Ofgem says that there are 21 to 23 domestic entities in the world, but those big six supply 70% of, but in the 1990s to 2000, they supplied like sort of 99% of energy.
So we could basically work towards making our own energy, and I've seen it workable to some level. I mean, you might need to buy some decent parts for a bike. You have to have a regulator in between the battery and projector, maybe one or two other devices, but in terms of really having people pedaling, it was actually really fun. Like, whilst people were watching it, you could still hear people pedaling, as in the sort of belt drive sound in the background. But because people were doing it themselves, it just needed two people. And anyway, projectors are not those, like, big clunky things anymore with a big bulb. Like, they're actually quite kind of compact and sort of energy-efficient things, even though, let's say, they come from really horrible technology to make them. But in general, it's like doable, and if people could sort of really pedal for their own shit, I think it would I had a dream.
But you're talking about a social systemic change, is what you're talking about, unfortunately. People can demand as much as they like, but if the people who control the system are dead against it, and more and more power is being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands in the commercial system, then you're not really getting too far, are you?
Well, I don't think I'm saying that.
No, I didn't mean you personally, I meant one.
Well, even as one as well, I think what I was saying previously about it's like snapping out of this mentality that we constantly have to ask permission, or we have to first, you know, wait for it to be able to purchase it and those things. Basically, people forever liked doing things themselves or having a project once there were like the component parts of it. People used to be able to buy the diodes, transistors, solder things, do projects, you know, those kinds of kids projects for Christmas, or courses, you know, they send you a thing in the post and it's a subscription, and every year you get like 6 projects and you do it with your kid. I imagine, yeah, I'm really imagining that once people see that they can do some pedal power themselves, they might, even as a spend, even as a sort of, we'll see what happens, I don't know if really I'm going to generate anything, but if they really can get to exercising and making that a bit of power, I think that wins a sort of, it may be token gesture in some way, but I think it really is like an empowerment victory in a small form, where they say, fuck, like, I always kind of believed in bicycles, I always believed in doing it ourselves. I personally, when I was young, I was like, why doesn't the city harvest us? Like, even in like a slave, I don't want to give them ideas here, or anyone ideas, but we're the best cyclers ever, just like, make a gym connected to like a power grid, for whatever it is, and you have people in the gym anyway running on those treadmills, like, why don't you just take that and use it? So, if I could think about people harvesting their kids somewhat, they always say, like, oh, you have to do it yourself, and be good, and if you want something, you have to earn it, and stuff. And it's like, well, yeah, you get on the bike as well.
Yeah. I've never owned a car, and I've been a cyclist all my life, so...
Oh, wow.
You see, I'm 64, so I had to be honest, though, once I started getting arthritis and had to get a mobility card there, but it's kind of not my car, so I still hold my hands up and say that I've never owned a car, but that's only been a couple of years. But for the most part, I've either cycled or run or walked or used public transport, which is fine by me. But you can't tell people that, and you can't tell car guys about cars. It's like you're teaching them some kind of psychosocial torture.
Yeah, promote it as a kind of fun project to do, a kind of test, tap into some psychosocial, test your masculinity, if you will, and say, like, can you run and, you know, charge this thing, or do you want to run whilst you watch your series instead of just sitting there? It's always these kinds of weird, fun ideas that I think also tap into innovation of sorts. So we might not create everything and reinvent the wheel ourselves, but if you look at these kinds of people who created aviation and all these things, they sort of like did weird things, like in terms of experimenting and putting things together, like, let's stick a bird's wing on this. And okay, I'm going to attach actually a large scale wing to myself, or I'm going to paint this like weird picture. And it's like, actually, from those things, like, I think it A, keeps us busy and doesn't get us just watching TV serials. It gets us off the couch. And and it gives, I think, the new generation some, you know, maybe it's a bit of hopium that I'm plugging here, but I think really once it connects to your psyche and it's like, fuck, you can actually connect these two wires to your back wheel with this little device, or I can solder it myself. And it's like, people start to get a bit Frankenstein, or they start to get weird ideas. And I think from that is where you see innovation of sorts. So I think a lot of this is out there. So that could help us. What else have you done, if I can ask? Like, so you went to Kenya, you went to Bangladesh, you helped some electric generation abroad?
Well, I was a lecturer in a number of universities. Speaking online like this is actually less of a problem than speaking to a large audience. I did my PhD in Nicaragua, and that was on credit unions and credit cycles, microcredit. So I've worked on, well, I've analysed that a bit. I can't say I've actually necessarily worked on it. I've written a fair bit about corruption as well, which is quite good. Because corruption and waste go hand in hand.
And is that rife in Nicaragua? Is that why you went there?
Yes, it is. Now, you could say, and I would say, that the UK is heading on a downward slope in corruption terms. It's hidden a lot more by the official systems of the media than it is over there. There, everybody knows it. It's a small country. The population at the time was only like sort of 2 and a bit million. It's tiny. So everybody knew most people.
Where is Nicaragua, by the way? Just
it's on the isthmus between Costa Rica and El Salvador.
So Central America.
Central America, yeah.
I don't think I've heard that word for such a long time.
No, it used to be all the buzz in the 1980s. You see, I'm 64, so I remember all this stuff. It's not really in the post as much as it used to be.
So why did you go there? That's interesting.
Well, in real life terms, it was a country of political interest anyway, because of the revolution they had there and all this kind of stuff. However, when I got to link up with the guy who supervised my PhD, he had already been there, he'd done his PhD there, so it became a kind of logical place to go because I was interested in it, and so he had contacts there.
That's
it.
That helped.
Plus, it had a whole bunch of microcredit organisations, so that was really great.
And also, just to clarify that, because I could guess, but it's always good in asking, like, maybe I will guess and you can let me know, but microcredits, is that kind of just like basically re-lending, or is it actual kind of tokens?
It's re-lending to small, poor, lower income families, basically. Hillary Clinton used to talk about this quite a lot, saying, the poor are just micro-entrepreneurs waiting for the right money to take off and then they'll all be rich. That was bullshit. But there were reasonable applications of it which kind of got pushed down the link in terms of setting up these big organisations just to make a profit. There's a whole bunch of really interesting stuff on it, but I don't suppose that's really necessarily a thing. But there are kind of credit cooperatives in the UK, but they're just not really popular.
And corruption, is that kind of just like reporting, journalistic, well, slightly?
Really, analytically, when you're in a country that has genetic corruption, sounds like an awful thing to say, but really, that was pretty much the case. Nicaragua. It sounds an awful thing to say, but working out what people mean by corruption, corruption is a term that everybody uses, and they're probably right in terms of the area and the place they use it in, but half the time people don't really understand what they're saying. So getting to understand how it works, socioeconomic systems that guide it, and so on and so forth, is actually a really fascinating thing. Because understanding and analysing various forms of corruption to work out if there is some sort of core beast in there, that's not what people think it is.
Part of what I see what we're doing, most of us, or all of us, or just myself, is getting to the bottom of those things. We're literally undoing each and every one of those layers, or sometimes even skipping to that core beast that you mentioned. And then we're saying that's, like, we're pointing the finger at that sort of, what is it? The person behind the curtain. It is that Wizard of Oz thing where there's this whole like song and dance around, which we think is like keeping life going or maybe healthy. But then we see like the core beast, the core person. I don't know, even like maybe original families that formed countries or, you know, from that basic thing. At least the history, if not, you know, pointing the finger at what is continuing the system. I think that is very empowering itself as well.
Yeah. So, talking about corruption, what you and I were talking about the power supply in the UK. If it is the case that power supply in the UK is dominated by these big companies, which it is, and if it is the case that the existing political system sees that as a good, fine thing and doesn't want to have the gas and electricity supply to the UK nationalised again, which is also the case, and if it is the case that the Ombudsman really basically lets the companies do what they like, then that in itself is a form of systemic corruption.
Oh, yeah.
Because what that is doing is making the people of the UK pay whatever price the oligopoly decides for it.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't give them any choice. Can't deal without electricity and gas, so on and so forth. So that's a form of corruption. You could possibly see corruption related to that in a country like Nicaragua, but it would be in a different form and in a different shape.
I think all of them, including the ombudsman's, are like in it to win it.
I'm not talking about a conspiracy. I'm not talking about, you know, them swapping money and being buddies and going to the same clubs and stuff like that. I'm talking about a kind of discreet system of handing over control. I'm talking about.
Isn't that the same thing?
Not really. If you had a proper ombudsman, for instance, it would keep a sharper eye on the prices that the energy system was paying. It would be trying to make sure that there were enough energy supplies for the average person to be paying a reasonable price, and it would be doing all it could to stop energy poverty in the UK, which we do have, even though it's in a kind of different shape. But we don't have that. We have a fairly latent passive ombudsman, which basically talks to the government, talks to the people. That's about it, really.
So I see, like, there's one that could be without and one that could be with corruption. And it's like, what's the incentive for them to be, or how would it work aside from the morality? What would propel them to keep doing that?
That's the thing. Going back to democracy, the point behind democracy is that it's supposed to provide checks and balances to slow down corruption. You never get rid of corruption. But if you know where corruption is, it's actually a kind of warning sign to you about how your system doesn't work. So you can use corruption to make your system better if you have checks and balances. But we don't have those. Or rather, in the UK, we had to an extent, say, I wouldn't care to say, when, say, 50s, 60s in the First World War. But now, our capitalist tragedy governments are getting rid of them, busy and destroying them as quickly as possible because they get in the way of what Elon Musk wants to be steal, and trying to take it in the governments of our country and the United States and so on and so forth.
And if you consider the state itself heading towards that kind of non-conversation or dishonesty, it seems like nothing can be expected to last in terms of ombudsmanship as corrupt and probably mostly leaning towards these things. Because I know that for many other people, the reason for doing things is maybe for innovation, helping people in hospitals, even though they are perhaps equally abused by capitalism and those higher up that run those services down. But something keeps people going, and that's one of my sort of analytical things.
You cannot have a human system where people always work to the best of their ability and its neutral objective, and everybody does the best they can.
Okay.
Human beings will always corrupt things.
Uh-huh.
But the whole point of our democracy is to accept that, is to accept the fallibility of individual humans, of small groups of humans, and companies of humans, and try and put in place checks and balances that, where another group will say, well, you're doing okay about this, but this is wrong, and try and restore the balance somehow within the system. And it will always fail, because human beings are very ingenious and inventive people. You know, you can get rid of one form of corruption, they normally invent another. So you can reasonably see the top billionaires, the Bill Gates, the Teals, the Musks as being the most corrupt people on the planet, because they're the best at diverting everything to themselves. So you have to understand the social system for what it is and not expect perfection from people.
Yeah.
What you can expect them to do. It's like, you know, when we owned the water system back in the 1970s, there was one really, really, really hot stuff. Everyone was filling their bathtubs, dobbing each other into the pulleys for water. Maybe you shouldn't necessarily have to expect, but everybody owned the water system and they were trying to restrict unfair access to it. Now it's privatized. I was talking to my wife about this. If I save water, all I do really is save money for a corporation. I don't make any difference to how much water is being used for a corporation, who it's going to, how corrupt the system is. So why should I bother?
Mm-hmm.
It's privately owned. I obviously agree that the UK should be saving water. But I save it for a private company that then ships it off to Saudi Arabia for a ton of money, which is a possibility. Why would I bother doing that?
So, my answer to that is a mini thing, even though you were just saying it as that. You have to really bypass it, I think. It's similar with the electricity. Like, I collect my own water, like, almost all apart from, like, some drinking water that I keep for tea. I have, like, an old swimming pool kind of thing, a relic, you know, sort of old container type thing for washing hands and whatever else. I've totally cut down my mains water consumption, you know, stuff from the roof. And also there is, like, a well, which I know many people are not going to have, but once you think in terms of 3/4 of the water I can actually just, you know, for washing my feet, I don't need drinking water. And also, just as a last wash, you have to clean, or it's fairly clean, and the last bucket is the cleanest water, but most of the water stuff you can, I think, save. What do you think? Like, can you imagine, like, saving water yourself and using basically buckets under the roof?
You can do that. I mean, you can have rain barrels in your garden. You can maximise the roof space to filter stuff off into your settling tanks and so on and so forth. So, yeah, you could do it to an extent. And the more you do it, the less water you use anyway. So you don't have to do it either completely or not at all. You have to feed in phases of use.
As long as you have, like, a backup or a neighbour or another source. Like, I can say definitely that I've done it and it works, like, even from a few roofs. Like, you know, the paint buckets, I get that from a local decorator and painter, person who does it for a living. So even the paint buckets I get free, and I just put loads of them out there. And really, like, I can just take one and put one back. And once it rains a little bit harder, or even if it's just a little bit, really, even like the 1,000-liter container, sort of white cubic thing, that fills up really quickly, like when you're inside, like not paying attention. So, both in like 3 buckets from your local decorator and painter, or as a sort of cubic funnel system from the roof, really, really works. So I recommend it anyway.
That's quite good. Can you send me, like, a link, or an email with a link in it, and I'll have a look at
we'll
that.
Will do, will do.
All right, then. Well, that's been nice to talk to you.
Yeah, nice. It's been great. Thanks for everything, and we'll catch up again.
We will.
All right. Take care. Bye. My idea of doing these points is often I don't prepare anything because I'm already sort of overloaded, if you will.
Right.
I think there are some people, I might include you here or Gio or other people, where they're confident enough in what they've been seeing for such a long time that it's kind of more enjoyable perhaps to free flow, just mention without too much depth and see what the other person thinks from various topics. And that sort of acknowledges it at least without even needing to make a big podcast out of it.
What's the relevance of degrowth to that system, and why is it necessary?
Mm.
That would be quite interesting to know.